I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it. All right, we're continuing the interview with Rabbi Harold Schulweis, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He passed away in 2014. This interview was in 2004. We now talk about whether or not he would attend an interfaith wedding ceremony and why or why not.
I've been asked that question often by parents, by members of the relatives, and of course by rabbis too. I want to say that if my daughter or my son, for whatever reason, decided that they are going to be married interfaith fashion, that in no sense cuts off my relationship as a father or as a Jew to my daughter and to my son-in-law. Because if it does, Judaism is perceived of as narrow, punitive, and vindictive. I love my children, I love my people. And by the way, if they talk about unconditional love, here's a test. If my son should be arrested for some crime, do you think I'm going to disenfranchise him? Am I going to the prison or not to visit him? Absolutely. Am I going to the wedding? Of course. You know why? That's not the last statement. Jews do not understand, non-Jews, don't understand the meaning of process. If you are interested in helping your daughter, let us say, who had an interfaith marriage, if you're interested in your potential Jewish grandchildren, the way you do this is not by saying, I'm not going to go. I'm judging, he's finished with me. But you're going to say, let's make these people as welcome as possible. Let us, so that we can embrace, and so that we're also teaching a lesson. Do you respect a religion that is so angry and so provincial that it would discourage its people from going to non-Jewish religious events? I took my board of directors to a mosque, the mosque in Culver City. The thing was called the King Saud Mosque. And some people were very critical. How could you do that? Well, because I wanted to indicate that we are not a provincial, parochial tradition, that we have a lot to experience and learn, and it's not going to make you less Jewish. It's going to make you more prideful. Because you show me a religion that says you cannot walk in. This was, by the way, what it was in before 1964, before Vatican II. I was a rabbi in Oakland. No Catholic could possibly enter my synagogue. They were all invited to bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs unless they got permission from the bishop. After the Vatican II, they were allowed. And you could see what happened. You had Catholic and Jewish people celebrating together. Twice we had Cardinal Mahoney here, with bishops and nuns and priests of all kind to celebrate, number one, the recognition of by the Vatican of the State of Israel, to celebrate the Mea Culpa document in which the church talked about its wrongs towards the Jewish people. And my Zeta would not understand it. He was a bishop, he was a cardinal with his regalia, singing Adon Olam? Ridiculous. But it was the most healthsome. You didn't lose a single Jew. You gained a lot of respect from a lot of Jews who say, to be Jewish is to be ghettoized. This is what I... So of course I would go to the interfaith marriage. I would not participate in it in the sense that I will not give a religious statement, but if they asked me at the reception to make a toast, I would do so.
Now we talk about how he would react to one of his children converting out.
You ask, what would happen if my daughter converted to Catholicism or to Protestantism or any other faith? The same thing, by the way, is asked by ministers about what would it, when your son or daughter converts to Judaism, how do you feel? What I respect in the Christian whose daughter, let's say, converted to Judaism is their attitude. They tell me, and I ask this constantly, some say, for example, and one of the converts to Judaism pointed out that their father has not spoken to her and would not attend the bar bat mitzvah. I think that's tragic. That's what I'm talking about, the Christian now. And on the other hand, I meet many, many converts who tell me that their parents embrace them, recognize that they are spiritual seekers, respect their choices. I would do the very same thing. This does not say there would not be regret, but I certainly would not blame myself for it, which I think is, what did I do wrong? Look, we are less than 2% of the population. You're going to send your kids to universities and colleges, to medical schools. They're going to meet non-Jews. It's inevitable with a small marriage pool that we have that they're going to meet some of them, fall in love. And of course, some of them are remarkable people. I always ask the Jewish parents, what did you feel about your son-in-law, the Catholic? He's a remarkable individual. Usually, if that is an attitude, you now teach that the Catholic has also got to be simpatico towards his Jewish by birth bride and to their children. Whether or not the children are going to be raised Jewishly depends upon the attitude of the Jewish community, including the Jewish family. Again, process is important. It's not the last word, that marriage. I have done conversions of many people way, way after the interfaith marriage in which they both decided to raise their child Jewishly and their kids are in the day school and are bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah. This, and he has not converted. He remains Catholic or Protestant. But I think that if you show an iron fist, you're going to get an iron fist. You say, see, the Catholic has to overcome the principle of extra ecclesia nulla salus. Outside of the church, nobody is saved. We Jews don't have to do that. I don't believe that if you're not Jewish, you're not going to be saved. I just believe that there is a great value in Jewishness. And my concern with my daughter is that obviously I was not able to convince her of the unique value of it. There are most of the people that I speak to who come to me and want me to officiate the marriage are shocked at their parents' sudden concern with Jewishness when they never attended, have nothing to do with Jewish life. But suddenly that becomes important. That duplicity, that hypocrisy, hurts us tremendously. I don't know how to answer it. What I do tell them is, look, I don't want you to think that your parents are Judaism. Therefore, I want you to come and learn. But the truth of the matter is, existentially, the parents are Judaism.
This next question is an either or. What would Rabbi Schulweis prefer? A wedding, a marriage between two non-observant Jews who have no intention of raising Jewish children, or an interfaith marriage where they have decided to raise the children Jewish?
It's a very interesting and difficult question, and I'd have to give it various kinds of answers because it's not easy. Because I can tell you, I have met self-hating Jews. I have met Jews who really don't like being Jewish in general, and genuinely. Now, from a halachic point of view, and I understand that too, still, mother was Jewish, mother is Jewish, that's it. That the mother doesn't believe, that the mother doesn't attend, that there's no Jewishness at home, well, so be it. That is the biological way of thinking, biological halachic way of thinking. But I will tell you that it is the likelihood of their children being Jewish is very minimal, because that their child will be assimilated into the mass culture of the secular world, which is tinged with Christianity, understandably. But I must tell you that if I deal with a Jew who marries a Jew by choice, that I find great confidence and great happiness. I don't consider this to be betrayal. I don't think it's weakness at all. In fact, as many, many sociologists, Egon Mayer and Gary Tobin, I forget, but I hope I get the name right. If you give me a moment, I'll look it up. Many demographers will tell you, and I can tell you from my own experience, that the difficulty that I have is after the conversion, because she comes to me and she says, I can't get my husband to a service. I did not drop Christianity to become nothing. I am a spiritual person. And this is so cliched. It's a stereotype. You remember there's a series called, you're probably too puristic to appreciate it, called Sex and the City, which I do not happen to watch, but my congregation told me to watch. And I do it for sociological reasons. There's one unusual scene in which one of the characters, Charlotte by name, who's non-Jewish, converts to Judaism. She goes out with a man called Harry, who is a Jew, who repudiated her because she's not Jewish, while he's eating a ham sandwich, by the way. She converts. One of the next scenes, is that Charlotte now has a veil over her eyes, and she is benching licht. She is reciting the blessing over the candles, and Harry is turning this way, trying to look at the television set. And I thought, my God, he captured it. So we have got to eliminate the conceit that just because a person is biologically Jewish, that he's going to be religiously, culturally Jewish, or Jewish loyally. So it's not a question of either or, it's a question of what you can do. When rabbis are hired, negotiated with, the boards by and large do not ask theological questions. They'll talk about salary, they'll talk about services, but they don't ask these kind of personal questions. And that indicates to you that this kind of philosophical and theological world is not something that the average Jew has been drawn to. Go ahead, sorry.
Now the rabbi's thoughts on Tikkun Olam.
Tikkun Olam has become, and I think interestingly and correctly, the major spiritual religious quest, because it is so rooted in morality, and because it is also so rooted in universalism. Today you will hear some people, including rabbis, who are out to defeat the evil of enlightenment, universalism, the love of humanity, etc., etc. I think they do Judaism an injustice, though I understand why they're doing it. There are lots of people who think that the choice in life is, do you love humanity or do you love the Jews? That's not the choice. The choice is, I love Jews and through Jews, love humanity. And Judaism teaches me to do that. And that's why Tikkun Olam has caught on. Because remember what it means is the repair of the world. It doesn't say the repair of the Jewish world, but of the world. So now you have, and this is a very Jewish notion in the Talmud, because the rabbis were far more liberal than they made out to be. The rabbis will say it is your duty to bury the dead of the non-Jew together with the Jew. It is your duty to feed the hungry of the non-Jew together with the hungry of the Jew. It is your duty to comfort the bereaved of the non-Jew together with the Jew. That's universalism. That's wonderful. That's marvelous. And that's why it's a unifying theme, because who will not identify with that? That secular Jew out there, surely. He may have different rationale, but everybody wants it. Plus the fact that what happens is it appeals to the activistic, heroic dimension of Judaism. Don't talk to me only about God. Talk to me about godliness. Talk to me about, don't tell me what God ought to do for you. Tell me what you ought to do for God. Don't tell me what the synagogue ought to do for you. Tell me what you ought to do for the synagogue. Don't tell me what is a Jew. Tell me what a Jew ought to be. And that is what Tikkun Olam captures, this notion of a heroic behavior, attitude towards the world, towards yourself, towards your neighbor. And they love that. What they find, unfortunately, and I'm writing about it, that's why I'm so particularly concerned about it. When they walk to the synagogue, my people think that when they don't see a relationship between God and themselves. See, the relationship is vertical. Say, God, you make peace. Oseh shalom bimromav. And what does it got to do with me? They don't see it. You say, you praise God. The people tell me, you're praising God over and over and over again, millions of prayers. Well, you're not praising God. You're praising godliness. And godliness means to me those virtues that are traditionally ascribed to God, which you have to incorporate, emulate, imitate, and realize. So it's not that God who makes peace. It's you who are expressing your godliness, make efforts in making peace. It's not God who picks up those who are fallen. You have got to pick up those who are fallen. It's not God who heals the sick. It's you and your community that makes the sick stronger. Well, this is a different change in perspective. It's not what the average Jew finds in the traditional service.
The topic turns to the afterlife.
The question that you ask is a question that I'm asked most often by Christians. In fact, it's the first question, probably the most important question, namely, what does Judaism believe about heaven, about hell, about the hereafter? And if they're more knowledgeable about resurrection from the dead. And I tell them that, look, first of all, when you ask a rabbi a question, you must expect a lot of answers, because there is no single answer to every question. In the question of the hereafter, there is certainly an emphasis in the prayer book, goes for the Orthodox and the conservative prayer book, on the hereafter. You talk about blessing God who has made the Mechayei HaMeitim, who has made dead alive again. So there is that notion, no question. But it is very, very sub voce. It's very, very silent. It's in the back, but it's not the emphasis. Most Jews that I know, and I would say this, most rabbis that I know, believe in the here now. And the emphasis is so much on the here now that the hereafter becomes an afterthought. And the reason for that is that when you concentrate upon the world beyond, you neglect your obligation to repair this world, to sanctify this world, to work here. And it's always the expectation of some, and the hereafter focus is to escape this world and its responsibilities. And one of the key benedictions, in fact, it introduces almost all benedictions, is blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the world. It means this world. This is the place where you've got to attend to. And if you looking with one eye on the reward, the sages will say, that's not the ideal thing. You are to do what is good, what is right, not because you're going to get a reward, but because it's right, it's good, and because you are serving God's children here on earth.
We now talk about something a little lighter. What is Rabbi Schulweis's favorite Jewish holiday and why?
That's easy, really very easy. Every rabbi is going to answer the same. Every Jew will answer the same way. I think the most fascinating holiday is Passover, because because they took it out of the synagogue into the home, which my non-Jewish friends and the Jews by choice also appreciate. Here is the holiday. It's the holiday which celebrates the beginning, the creation of the Jewish people. And you celebrate it at home, without the rabbi, without the cantor, without the choir. And there's a transformation. Suddenly you, layman, you are the teacher. You are the cantor. You are the preacher. You are the narrator. Secondly, it involves the extended family and friends. And that also is important, because Judaism is not just for and by the individual. It's not for the solitary individual alone. It's always with community, with others. And thirdly, what I find exciting is this wonderful Talmudic question. Who recites the four questions? Answer is the youngest. Why the youngest? Probably because the youngest never has a chance to ask questions. And if you have no children, then your wife, because in those days they assumed the wife had no strength to ask questions. But the critical question is, what if you're all by yourself? And the answer that is given is, from the Talmud, is Sho'el et atzmo. He must ask himself. Why is that? After all, you know the answer. And the answer to that question is because free people ask, slaves don't. To indicate that you are no longer a subservient individual to a master, you ask questions even of yourself. So in Judaism, the question is far more important than the dogma.
What is the Talmud and why is it important?
The Bible is not the last word in Jewish life. It's the first word. People have a notion that if you read the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, you're finished. The interesting thing is what happens after the five books of Moses are given. Now you have interpretation. You have Midrash, which means to probe and to ask questions. You have a Mishnah, which is dated around the 200 CE. You have the Talmud, which put another 500, 600 years. But basically what they are interpretations of the Bible, because the Bible is very succinct. It'll tell you, for example, you shall keep the Sabbath. But how do you keep the Sabbath? This becomes a Talmudic question. My favorite Midrash, which I love and which has helped me a great deal, is found in a Midrash called Psikta de Rav Kahana. It's a wonderful question. Typically, they ask what a question. How, they ask sages, how is it possible that 600,000 Jews were at the foot of Sinai And everyone heard God say, I am the Lord thy God, not you all, but individually. The answer is, to my mind, exquisite. Rabbi Levi says, because God is to be understood as a mirror. The metaphor is mirror. And therefore, 1,000 people can look into it. The mirror is the same, but there is a reflection of the individual, different individual, accordingly. And he goes on to say, the same Midrash, do not think it is different with the manna. Do you think everybody tasted manna the same way? No. The little child tasted the manna in one way, the older person another way, the adolescent in another way. Do not think that this is unusual, because it says, the voice of the Lord in strength. It doesn't say the voice of the Lord in God's strength, but the voice of the Lord in strength. What does that mean? Rabbis explain, the voice of the Lord is understood and heard according to the strength of every individual. Don't expect every individual to hear it the same way or to see it the same way, because again, you have God who is a mirror. To my mind, that is one of the most advanced notion of inclusiveness and of pluralism. So what you must understand is, whatever God concept you have, it is a reflection of your own life invariably. And what you should do is to get together with other people and ask, what's your conception? What's your reflection? And together it develops the oneness of God, which I think is the great answer and ending to the Shema Yisrael.
It seems that Jews like to point out famous Jews, whether that famous Jew has any connection to Judaism or not. Why?
The question is, why are you proud of Jews who are not really Jewishly observant or even identify? And the point is, I love Spinoza. I'm so happy that he was Jewish. I love Karl Marx. I love Freud. None of these people were Jewishly Jewish. Many were very assimilated. Even Einstein was quite removed from Jewish life. So why is it that I have this tremendous pride? Because I believe that many of them were not aware of the spirit of their approach, their Jewishness. For example, it's interesting that many of them are intellectuals, and they worship the idea. Where do they get that from? You don't get that from secular culture. For example, my mother, if a book is dropped in her home in the synagogue, will run over, pick it up, and kiss it. Where do you recite a blessing before you read the book, like the Torah? In Judaism, a blessing before you don't do it before Goethe. You can read Shakespeare. I don't hear anybody blessing it. It's remarkable. My grandfather, at the end of the service, would go around from pew to pew, closing prayer books and closing the Bibles. And I said to him, Zeta, why are you doing that? He was a very impatient guy. I was generally surprised that he did that. And he said, look, if you have a conversation with somebody and you finish the conversation, do you walk away from him? You open up that book. You had a conversation. How don't you now say goodbye to it? So he went around closing it. The point being that we have a particular notion that ideas are sacred, that study is sacred. When the temple was destroyed in 70 CE, the rabbi said, how do you possibly relate to God? We don't have a temple, we don't have sacrifice, we don't have a priest. And the answers were, we do it through many things, but one of the most important is Torah. It's the study. You want to celebrate the bar mitzvah, the bat mitzvah of a child who now becomes a adolescent with a sense of conscience, what do? He's got to, she's got to master the Torah. So this is one of the reasons we're proud. Secondly, of course, we're proud because we recognize the ugliness of anti-Semitism that so kept Jews from all kinds of professions. I remember that Ludwig Lewis and, among others, Lionel Trilling could not teach. These were remarkably scholarly persons, with more than PhDs, could not teach in universities because their field was English literature. And they said, how can a Jew teach Chaucer? Well, when they made it, when these people made it, you're proud. You're proud of the fact that they were able to overcome. And they're Jewish enough. There is also a romantic, sentimental notion. And that's called in Yiddish, das Pintele Yid, which means the point of the Jew, which is an attachment, a sentimental attachment to things Jewish that you find even in people like Heinrich Heine, who converted to Christianity. You find it in all kinds of people. And that sentiment is an attachment to your family, to your larger family. So this is my family. You have a family album, I got a family album. Open it up, you got the uncle. That uncle was not a nice guy. That aunt was a machshefer. She was difficult, he was a witch. It's my family album. And that includes other people as well. People who distance themselves from Jewishness. And the other answer is that I have a feeling, maybe it's a conceit, that if you talked to Freud and were able to reveal to him what you have experienced as a Jewish scholar, as a Jewish theologian, that he may see things that he didn't get. How many Jews are there who had a bad experience in their formative years, in Hebrew school or day school, whatever, and who still have it against Judaism? And you want to take these people and say, look, that teacher was not the whole of Judaism. For that matter, your father wasn't the whole of Judaism. So it is, again, a constant growth. And then there is this question of a collective ego. I mean, am I proud that my child is Phi Beta Kappa? Yeah, I am. Certainly am. Am I glad that my people have produced so many Nobel Prize winners? Sure, why not? Should I only be proud of the fact that my people have produced great warriors, killers?
Okay, that wraps up number 3 out of 4. And if you like what you hear, click subscribe. And if you're looking for a great Jewish board game, go to PassoverGame.com. PassoverGame.com, they have Chametz, the search is on, which compares to Clue. And a great thinking game that you can play in the car or at the table called Yiddish Cup. So go over to PassoverGame.com and check it out.